This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. At least 111 people have died in the Maui wildfires, and many haven't even found their loved ones who were unaccounted for. Yet there's word that real estate speculators have shown up. CBS's Lilia Luciano in Lahaina.
There's a new worry for Lahaina residents who survived the inferno.
Lahaina is not for sale. I repeat, Lahaina is not for sale.
Hawaii's governor is considering a moratorium on all land transactions in Lahaina to protect locals from opportunistic buyers.
Please don't approach them with an offer to buy land. Please don't approach their families to tell them that they're going to be better off if they make a deal.
Canada's worst ever wildfire season is bracing for another challenge. Cliff Chapman is head of British Columbia Wildfire Operations.
We are expecting significant growth, and we are expecting our resources to be challenged from north to south in the province over the next 48 hours.
Meantime, some 20,000 people in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories have been told to evacuate due to a wildfire that is approximately 10 miles away. A change of plans for former President Trump. Details from CBS's Christopher Cruz.
Trump had promised to hold a news conference next week to release a report that he said would prove there had been fraud in the 2020 presidential election in Georgia. He made the announcement shortly after he was indicted in Georgia on election interference charges. Now Trump says he has canceled that press conference, and his attorneys will put his arguments about alleged election fraud in court filings instead. Christopher Cruz, CBS News, Washington.
With Hurricane Hilary gaining strength in the Pacific and expected to move into Baja, Mexico and northward, it could become the first tropical storm to make landfall in California in 84 years. Chris Warren with the Weather Channel is keeping tabs.
Hilary rapidly intensifying into an impressive looking storm, and it is expected to get even stronger as it heads to the north, looking at the possibility of a major Category 4 hurricane by Saturday.
A spate of smash-and-grab robberies and flash mob thefts in Los Angeles is prompting action. Mayor Karen Bass has announced the formation of a multi-agency task force aimed at fighting retail crime.
Our number one job is to keep Angelenos safe and to feel safe. When incidents of brazen theft and robbery occur, it shatters that feeling of safety.
A small aircraft lost control and crashed on a highway in Malaysia's central Selangor state, killing all eight people on board and two on the ground. A motorcyclist and the driver of a car were hit when the plane crashed as it was on approach to a nearby airport. Stocks fall on Wall Street. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. Canadian wildfire smoke is once again triggering a statewide air quality advisory, which will last through Monday at 6 a.m. Wildfires north of the border have caused several air quality alerts this summer. Earlier this year, air quality was the worst it's been in over a decade, with a late June stretch causing the air quality in Wisconsin to drop to the worst in the world for a couple of days. Officials say to limit time spent outdoors, especially children and people with health conditions, when air quality is unhealthy. A national trucking company that recently filed for bankruptcy is making layoffs in Wisconsin. Yellow Corporation said 46 employees in Toma and 9 more in Eau Claire will lose their jobs as the company deals with its financial issues. Other Wisconsin locations are impacted as well, with Nina laying off 86 employees. 261 employees are being laid off in the state of Wisconsin, according to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. The company has 22,000 employees nationwide. From the Civic Media Newsroom in Western Wisconsin, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. 93.5, The Tap. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5, The Tap.
Boom, a clean energy boom. Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these booms and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, earlier today, I was watching one of the, the TikTok, YouTube, one of the videos of a guy in Canada just railing against Justin Trudeau and how the mortgage rates are going through the roof and how, you know, people are going to get screwed out of their homes. And look, you know, these mortgage rates they're going up. And I don't know what we should and can be doing, which is why I thought it'd be a good idea to talk to our good friend Morris Pearl. He is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's great to be in your show, Rick. Thank you.
So have you been seeing these stories coming out of, you know, places like Canada? I haven't seen as much here as I saw there, but interest rates are going up. There's this concern that, you know, people are going to lose their homes and nobody's going to buy houses. And I know some hoping and wishing for recession. What are you seeing?
Well, I mean, people have got some valid concerns. Interest rates are now a lot higher than they were like a year ago. You know, interest rates have gone from, you know, below 3. If you could have taken out a mortgage a year ago with interest rate a little below 3. If you buy a house today, you're paying a little above 7 on your interest rate, probably. And that's a huge difference. That's a difference of like a payment of like $1,200 versus $2,000. And if you can afford to pay $1,200 a month for your mortgage, maybe you can't afford the $2,000 a month payment.
Right.
You know, and maybe you can't buy that house. So that's a problem for people.
But what do you say to the person, Morris, who goes, well, you know, at the end of the road, it doesn't matter. If the interest rates are higher, people aren't going to be able to pay the high prices, so the prices are going to have to come down. And at the end, it all comes out in the wash anyway. What do you say to that argument?
Well, to a large extent, I believe it. For house, you know, in area where people get mortgages, if for the multi-million dollar house that people pay cash for, it doesn't apply. But for the $500,000 houses and $200,000 houses that people get mortgages for, yeah. When you go to look for a house, the broker is going to ask you about how much money you make and check your credit score. And they're going to figure out what kind of mortgage you can qualify for. And if they say, okay, you're going to qualify for a mortgage, you can pay, you know, $1,300 a month based on your salary. You can qualify for a mortgage of this much. That's how much you can afford to pay for the house. And if everybody's in the same boat, well, if the guy wants to sell the house, that's what he's going to get for it.
Yeah.
And interest rates are going up for everybody pretty much. So I kind of believe that argument to an extent. When rates go up, that's bad for house prices. But an additional thing that's happening now is that so many of these guys who are, own houses do have mortgages of like 3%. Mortgages were below 4% for a couple of years. And so their thing, well, I could downsize, but if I downsize, I'm going to have to get a 7% mortgage on the smaller place and pay even more. So why bother? And so a lot of people, they're just saying, sorry, I can't afford to move. So a lot fewer houses are for sale right now. And people are, you know, there's less houses available. And so those few that are available because somebody really has to move, you know, they have to move to a different part of the country or, you know, their spouse died or something. Those people are able to hold out for higher prices. But that's, I think if mortgage rates continue to go up, house prices will kind of go down to correspond to that. You know, I'm 63. I remember, you know, the 1980s when mortgage rates were above 12 for 5 years in a row, you know?
No. I had a relative that I spoke with earlier who said the same thing. They bought their house back in the early 80s. Their mortgage was 12%. And he said, you know, like you wrote most of that off. He goes, but the reality is that our wages were sufficiently high enough to cover that. That as inflation went up, our wages went up because you had cost of living adjustments and union contracts. So it didn't hurt as bad as it's hurting working people today because wages haven't kept up with inflation over the last 40 years.
No, they haven't. But wages are starting to catch up now. That's really what drives me crazy. I read the Fed minutes that came out, I think it was yesterday. You know, they're concerned, wages are continuing to go up. We have to get them back in line with their historical norms of percentage of profits and things like that. It's like, I can't stand this.
Yeah, but at what period in history are you talking about? You know, when I started
yesterday.
Working...
Yesterday.
You know, I go back to, you know, the late 80s when I started working, and the job that I currently do, I started off making $15 an hour, top rate a little bit over 18. Right now, that same job starts off at 21, not 15. And we're talking 35 years later, a very small increase. Wages have not kept up historically. If we could go back to the way the wage structure was in the late 80s, I wouldn't be unhappy with that.
Well, I just meant things have improved since like 6 months ago, 9 months ago. You know, a few more places are getting unionized. The UPS people got a contract with the Teamsters. Starbucks is getting unionized here and there. Amazon is paying more. Over the last 6-9 months, things seem to be looking a little bit better for the working people. That's all I'm saying.
No, you're right. So I know a lot of people are blaming Biden for this mess. Is this his fault?
I don't think it's his fault. Maybe he could get the people in the Fed to not raise interest rates as much and not worry about inflation so much. But that is kind of their job to worry about inflation.
Does he have the power to do that?
Like inflation. Well, he does appoint them. And presumably he tries to appoint people that like him, I would think. So he might have some influence on them. But no, not, he doesn't have direct power to control the Fed. They're independent once they're appointed. He's trying to do things like forgive student loans, provide more money, you know, in infrastructure projects so more people have jobs. So putting more people, more money in people's pockets, that's what he can do, or what Congress and the president together can do to do this. Now, of course, some people don't like the idea of student loans being forgiven. Some people don't like the idea of the federal government paying for more roads and bridges and stuff like that.
Right, but Congress isn't going to do any of that stuff because we've got a divided Congress. And look, how is he going to have any influence over the Fed? You know, Jerome Powell was put in place by Trump.
Well, that's true. That is true. Jerome Powell, I think he's a reasonable guy. He's really afraid of inflation, and he's afraid of, like, you know, taking his hands off the controls and then suddenly seeing inflation spike up again. And then say, oh my God, this guy's a complete idiot. So, you know, he's a little scared, I think. But I'm hoping that they'll decide that having the economy growing is actually a good thing, even if that does cause some inflation. They do have a dual mandate, right? High employment and low inflation at the same time.
Well, how do you do that? And I've always wondered that, even, you know, back when I was in taking Econ 101 1,000 years ago, I still wonder, how do you have this dual job where one affects the other? If you have low inflation, the way of getting inflation down is to cause more unemployment. How do you juggle that? If you have full employment and everyone has jobs, a tighter labor market, wages, you know, just, or how is explained by the X graphs, you know, wages go up. How do you balance
that? Yeah. And we think that's good if labor markets are tight and wages are going up and unions are negotiating better contracts. I think that's a good thing. And yes, it does cause inflation. If everybody in your town gets a raise, chances are the guy at the bar is going to be raising the prices of the beer. Chances are the guy who owns the apartment building is going to be doing leases for higher rates next year. Yeah, if you have more money, you can pay people. People will increase the price of things too. But hopefully the people can get raises more than the amount that prices are going up. And sometimes that's working.
But here's, and that's here, what we can, here's how it was for. Explained to me. And, you know, again, I'm going back to what 1,000 years ago of economic, the economic class I took. You know, as long as inflation is under what wage increases you've got, that's a good thing, especially for working people, especially for people in debt. If your wages are just above inflation, your life is better. You're having a better standard of living. But we've been under that water for a while. And that's why I think you see the anger and the frustration a lot of working people have.
Well, inflation is actually could be a helpful thing if you have a huge mortgage.
Yeah.
Your mortgage, if you own a house with a big mortgage, the mortgage is the one thing that does not go up with inflation. If you're in a rental, then you're in trouble. If you have a lot of cash in your bank account, well, you can buy less stuff when prices go up. So it's bad for people with a lot of cash, good for people with a lot of debt. There was a time when people ran for office with the idea that we're gonna have more inflation, that's a good thing. You know, particularly in the farming areas where the farmers had huge mortgages.
Right. And this is why the reason I'm going in this direction is my grandparents, they bought their house in the late 60s. And by the late 70s, their mortgage was a day's pay. Inflation had gone up that much to where the home that they bought that they were struggling to pay in the 60s was an absolute joke by the late 70s. I don't ever see that happening today for working people, but I don't think a little bit of inflation is bad.
It will. It can. If inflation is a few percent per year for 30 years, yeah. And if you can get a 7% mortgage now on a home, and if the inflation goes up, both wages and house prices, 3 or 4% or 5% for 30 years, that mortgage is going to look like a joke 29 years from now.
Yeah.
And the guy's going to feel brilliant when he sells his house for $1 million and is making a couple hundred bucks in mortgage payments. Now, so you have to, over the long term, those things work. Over the short term, they don't. You know, your parents are probably felt pretty stupid 3 months after they bought the house when they were kind of having to budget, you know, how much to spend on food. But 20 years after that, they felt brilliant. So.
No, it's a good point. And also the fact is at that time, you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, you know, CD rates and saving rates were much higher than they are now. And I'm not seeing that same dynamic. So I think this is another reason people are frustrated with bankers and banks, because they feel like they're being gouged.
Well, what happened in the 1970s, people started taking all their money out of the banks and buying government bonds that were paying like 12%. That's when the banks started raising interest rates. That was essentially when money market funds were invented, was in the mid-1970s. So I think people are starting to take their money out of banks now and putting it into other things. You can get government bonds that pay around 6.5-7%. Government guaranteed,
yeah.
You know, mortgage-backed securities that pay 6.5%. You can buy them.
Yeah, I got one last year for 10%.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, last line of questioning I've got for you on this topic, where do you see things going? I mean, because that's the big question. Are we creating an environment where, you know, the real estate industry is going to go bust? Do we see a boom coming? What are we seeing?
I'm hoping what we're seeing is things just kind of staying the way they are for a while. Prices not going up too much, wages going up slowly, and people living happily thereafter. You know, I think I choose to be an optimist. I think, you know, more workers are demanding higher pay, and I think they're getting it in some cases, like the Teamsters and the UPS. And I think that we're seeing inflation dying down. I think it mostly came because of supply chain issues, of shortages of stuff, and people raising the prices of when they were short of stuff. And these, you know, people like Chipotle saying, oh, well, now there's no more shortage, but we're leaving the prices where they are, and people are still paying, and we're making enormously higher profits. I think eventually that will go away, and prices will kind of remain constant for a while. So I choose to be an optimist, Rick.
I want to share your optimism. I do. But we'll see how it plays out. But as always, Morris, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
You as well, our good friend Morris Pearl. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you happy where we are? Or are you kind of a little tentative like I am? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A couple of emails questioning my position on Kyrsten Sinema. Evidently, some folks in Arizona, some fans of Kyrsten. I can't imagine there are many. The polling not doing well for her. But questioning, you know, my questioning her being involved. You know, she's a U.S. senator. I get that. How about you're a U.S. senator? You go to him and say, hey, this is stupid. Let's fight a different battle. But this is, as I said, you know, weak and stupid. That makes me crazy. And you have both here. Sinema's weak and Tuberville's stupid. And what you have then is this, well, we got to find compromise. And I don't know what that compromise is other than Biden surrendering something. Other than Biden, caving, which Republicans know Democrats will do. I mean, one of the things that I remember Dick Cheney saying, there was an issue in front of them and they go, the Democrats will cave. It's what they do because of this idea of compromise. And as I said a moment ago, the reason a lot of working class voters have turned to the Republican Party is they look at Democrats as weak. They look at Democrats as, which is why, you know, when we go out and we talk to people, people go to me, well, you can't be a Democrat, because I don't back down from my beliefs. I don't back down from my true north. And I will stand and argue until the cows come home. Because I'm passionate about what I believe. And they don't necessarily, the people that I know don't believe that Democrats think that way, because they are willing to compromise. And understand, it's because they're not willing to tear the country apart. They're not willing to destroy the House. Whereas a lot of my Republican friends are, burn it down. Yeah, we'll burn down the House. And this is what Tuberville's willing to do. To get his pound of flesh, he's willing to put the country in peril. He's willing to allow the military to go rudderless for a while. He's willing to have not the full complement of chief justices, not willing to get the promotions and people into the positions on the military that need to be. Now, remember, as we've said in the past, you know, our internal fights, you know, the way it's always framed is, you know, we're siblings. You know, we're going to pound the heck out of each other. We're going to beat each other up. We're going to humiliate each other. We're going to call each other names. But outside the borders, you better not. It's like my kids. My kids tear into each other constantly. But if somebody else goes after one or the other, they're unified. You don't talk to my sibling like that. And that's kind of how this country, I always thought this country was. That we may not agree. We may fight like, you know, cats and dogs. But when it comes to the water's edge, we're united. So to have something like this go on as long as it's gone on is quite distressing. And then to have cinema come and go, you know, you need to find a common ground, compromise. Here's the common ground. Do your job, dumb guy. Do your job. Put those people where they belong. Make your stand on something else. Because the pound of flesh is, what he wants is, you know, we're going to ban care for women in the military. That's his pound of flesh. Now, it goes back to what I've always said about, you know, how Democrats and Republicans operate. You know, Republicans always, you know, they want what they want and they stand on that. So they come, like any negotiation, everybody has their wish list. But they come and say, well, look, we want both your legs. Got to have both legs. And you got Democrats saying, no, we need both our legs. No, got to have both of them. Got to have them both. How about just one? And they take one leg 6 months later and go, you know, we need the other one. We need the other leg. How about just to the knee? You know, and eventually they get what they want by holding the country hostage. So this idea that, you know, well, we're gonna compromise. There are some things you don't. Now, there's common ground on a lot of things, but there are some things that are a matter of principle. Now you can say, hey, you know, that's what Tuberville's doing too. And it is. He's taking a principled stance, you could argue. The question then becomes, as a country, as a voter, are you okay with that? And this is why we have elections, to throw the bums out. Because poll after poll shows the vast majority of people are on the other side of Tuberville. It's frustrating and it's angering where we are. But it is what it is. You want to talk about something else that's frustrating? Now, I'm still stuck on this thing with Tuberville. I got to tell you. You know, I'm not a military person. As an institution, I struggle with having such a large military and the funding and the expenditures and the money that we spend on it. We could spend it in a lot of other places. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about, we're going to hold the people who do all the fighting and dying and bleeding, we're going to hold them hostage. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the fact that we haven't taken care of our veterans, that we haven't done the things that we said we were going to do. I have a problem that we've allowed another war to happen, and people are who actually make the sacrifice are the ones who are held out to dry. This is my problem with Tuberville. And he has brought out all of that in me. The fact that this is the stand that he has chosen to make is quite infuriating. And I hope the people in Alabama take this to heart. I hope the people in Alabama understand what he is doing, not just to our military at home, but abroad. This showing a sense of weakness, this showing a sense of division, this showing the world that we can't do the simplest thing without there being red hat, blue hat. It shows weakness. And I'm sorry, I don't see what the compromise is. I don't see where Christian Sinema is coming from. I don't see where what Joe Biden can do. And it's a lot of this stuff. I don't see what Biden can do in a lot of these scenarios that are out of his control. But I guess the narrative is that we can blame him for everything. And look, he's president. He deserves to be blamed for everything. But we've got to be smart enough to know what he's actually to be held accountable for and whatnot. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Again, it's the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. We're going to find out what that's doing on the green, on the green front. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that workers at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota, went out on strike. They were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local P9. Hormel had slashed workers' wages by 23% during the early 1980s. Benefits were also diminished and incentive programs rolled back. These changes cut deeply into the Hormel workers' earnings. What had been considered a good job was changing drastically. This was the story for many workers in Reagan-era America. The 3,500 Hormel workers voted overwhelmingly to strike. The National UFCW discouraged the action. The strike lasted more than a year. Strikebreakers were brought in, including some of the union members who crossed the picket line to return to work. The National Guard was called in to keep the peace between strikers and the scabs. After a year, the strike went down in defeat. Even after the strike, many of the workers were not called back to work. They were put on waiting lists for a job to reopen. Some never returned to the plant. 25 years after the strike, the Austin Daily Herald staff wrote, quote, "What resulted was a bitter, drawn-out labor dispute that drastically impacted the community, from workers who lost their jobs to families that were torn apart by the picket lines." The strike became the feature of a documentary by Barbara Koppel. In 1990, the documentary American Dream won the Academy Award. The film tells the story of the Hormel strike as a window into the tragic experiences of many workers during the 1980s. The film was made on a shoestring budget. Singer Bruce Springsteen provided $25,000 to help support this important film. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
When your political opponents push extremist public policies that would be disastrous for America, should you wring your hands in dread or applaud? Consider Project 2025, put together by former Trump officials and the Koch brothers' network of billionaire plutocrats. Their strategy is to win the presidency next year by demonizing all environmental protections and promising to halt all national efforts to cope with the obvious crises of climate change. Their proposals include repealing regulations that curb fossil fuel pollution, terminating our nation's transition to renewable energy, shutting down all environmental protection agencies, encouraging more oil and gas use, and promoting the deadly delusion that global warming is not a real problem. Moreover, they intend to implement Project 2025 in the first 180 days of a right-wing Republican presidential term, obviously anticipating that Donald Trump will be that president. "We're not tinkering at the edges," brags a far-out right-wing group that instigated the scheme. "We are writing a battle plan and we are marshaling our forces." They've already drawn up a list of agencies and policies they'll begin eliminating on day one. And they've readied a list of some 20,000 right-wing henchmen to put on the federal payroll immediately to enforce their plan. If this sounds ludicrous, it is. But it's actually happening. For the Republican Party has decided to be ludicrous. As the director of Project 2025 told the New York Times, "This is where the conservative movement sits at this time." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Maybe, but it damn sure won't sit well with the American people, who are presently suffering the hellish ravages of our rapidly overheating climate. Indeed, here's a great chance for Democrats to demonstrate their bipartisan spirit by doing all they can to publicize the Republicans' let-it-burn global warming policy." We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act, and look, inflation's coming down. That is a good thing. Drug prices a little bit coming down, especially on insulin. That's a good thing. But more importantly, we're cleaning and greening our economy, and that is a great thing. And here to bring the class war wonk, I've asked Ben Beachy to come talk with us. He's Vice President of Industrial Policy at the Blue-Green Alliance, bluegreenalliance.org, the website. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here.
So the one-year anniversary of a bill I never thought was actually going to happen, but some really good stuff coming out of this, isn't there?
Yeah. It's a look, it's a really historic wave of federal funding to, transform our economy. Not only is it the largest climate investment in U.S. history, it's also one of the biggest investments in revitalizing manufacturing in this country, and creating access to higher paying jobs for millions of people, and investing in communities who have seen decades of divestment. So it has the potential to be a real win-win-win for climate, for jobs, and for justice.
I've been saying for a while that, you know, the way we rebuild our economy is you have to start with an industrial policy, which we haven't had for a very long time because we've believed in the invisible hand and, some magical, mythical thinking. But this is actually a policy to move us in two good directions. One, the jobs from manufacturing, as you point out, but getting us somewhat off the dirty stuff into more clean, green energy. I don't see a downside.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? We're already starting to see some results here, even before the spigot of funding has fully opened. You know, President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act just 1 year ago. And already in that time, we've seen companies announce a wave of clean energy and clean manufacturing investments that are projected to create more than 170,000 jobs across 44 states. You know, that's faster than anyone predicted. And as the programs get stood up and the federal funds start to flow, those investments will only increase, as will the job creation. And I think it's important here to zoom in on manufacturing, just because, as you named, industrial policy was like a dirty word during decades of neoliberalism. But it's back. It's back. And we right now are intentionally using all of the levers available to us, including the levers of government, to grow sectors of the economy that are strategically imperative for a cleaner, more prosperous, and more equitable economy, right? And so that includes manufacturing. So in just the last year, manufacturers have announced 83 new or expanded clean energy manufacturing facilities, right? These are the facilities that are going to make the widgets for solar, for wind, for batteries, for our clean energy future. And that is critical because it shows that, we need not hitch our climate goals to vulnerable overseas supply chains that are marred by labor abuses and higher levels of pollution, shipping bottlenecks. Instead, with these investments, we have an opportunity to build our clean energy future on a foundation of good jobs, more reliable supply chains, and clean manufacturing. Yep. That was always the right thing to do. Now it's the most economical thing to do.
No, and look, this is one of the things I give Joe Biden the most credit for, that they're moving away from decades-old bad policy and moving us back to some good policy ideas. Because, look, I just went to see the movie Oppenheimer. And this is one of those things that it popped into my head the other day. I was watching the movie and what's his name? Matt Damon's character was talking to, the other character. He goes, whatever you need. The guy goes, build me a town. They built him a town. Whatever they needed to get that project done, the Manhattan Project done, they did it because they said, we're going to do this and we're going to do it no matter what. So for me, the idea of a Manhattan type project in green energy or industrial policy is appealing because it says as a country, we're all united in going this direction. And I think we need to get there.
Yeah. I mean, look, my simplest defense of industrial policy is when one has a goal, it is helpful to have a plan. Right. I mean, for years, we have been outsourcing plans to corporate boardrooms. And now for once, you know, we, the people, are taking back the plan. And that involves transforming our economy. One additional element that I want to name, I mentioned climate and jobs and justice, just to drill down on the justice element, right? These investments are a really rare opportunity to invest in communities that have endured, you know, decades of divestment, right? Communities hollowed out by unfair trade deals, communities excluded by racist practices like redlining, communities that are right now enduring shifts in energy, right? The energy transition we're going through. Communities that have been harmed by environmental injustice. Right now, we have the opportunity to tie strong equity and labor and environmental standards to all this funding that's going out the door so as to equip these hard-hit communities to translate these federal investments into higher-paying jobs, cleaner air, stronger local economies, right? That's the opportunity we face. It's not just to transform how we power our economy, but how power is distributed among our communities.
No, that's an excellent way to put it. But for me, it's sound policy, smart investment. That's the way forward. Now, you talked about private money going into building all this stuff. And that's what happens when you have public dollars going in that direction, which is why I've always said I'm a big supporter of public-private partnerships, as long as they operate in the way of using public dollars to get a public outcome using private interests, not ensuring that private interests get public dollars for themselves. And I think there's a distinction there.
That's absolutely right. Right. I mean, here, what we're doing is, you know, leveraging the power of public dollars to spur a sea change in how private dollars also flow. Right. You know, private dollars need to be guided. We are guiding them now. We are guiding them towards wind and solar power, but also wind and solar manufacturing. We're guiding them towards, electric vehicles and also electric vehicle manufacturing. We're guiding them towards retrofits of our homes and offices to make them cleaner, more efficient, and healthier. Right? These are things that were always the right thing to do. But the corporate boardrooms alone, we're not going to do it. They needed some guidance. And right now, what you see is basically a $2 trillion guidance.
Or you could look at it a different way. There's one way to herd cats, and that's put out a little food. Put out the food dish, and they will come. And look, the $2 trillion, that's an incentive to move in a direction and to bring those jobs back. Now, I got to tell you, I hate the idea that we're funding corporate America to do the right thing, but we're in a moment where I don't know that there's any other way for this to happen. Or do you see any other way than the path that we've taken?
Look, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. This is not the only one. But I do think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Those investments that I just named at the outset, right? Those are all private investments, right? And those private investments will matter to folks on the ground if we get the details right, who are going to be able to take good, high-paying jobs, often jobs that are accessible to folks without a bachelor's degree. These are investments that will clean up the air in communities that have seen, decades of toxic pollution. These are investments that will, invest in the local tax revenue of communities like mine and central West Virginia, like communities across the country that have been harmed by, like I said, unfair economic policies, unfair trade deals, energy transition, and the lot. So yes, it's true that a lot of this is public dollars guiding private investments. But if we get the details right, if we tie those investments to labor standards, to equity standards, they can make a real difference for folks on the ground.
Now, you mentioned your former state of West Virginia. Joe Manchin, the senator from there, vowed just, I think it was just yesterday, in fact, that he was going to fight the radical climate agenda. Seems a curious time on the first anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act that is going to take a step in dealing with our climate issues. Seems an interesting time to be throwing that out of fighting the radical the radical agenda.
Yeah, I don't even begin to suggest that I have a sense of what Joe Manchin is thinking at any given time. So I think I'll let that one be.
No, but the reason I bring this up is because, look, West Virginia is an energy state. This is a perfect place, and you mentioned, you know, going into places that have been left behind, that have been left out in the past, that have suffered from deindustrialization or moving away from certain things such as coal. This is an opportunity to fill those voids. I mean, you know, last October and in November, we did a multi-state tour where we went to places that used to be all those faces, places that had factories that were the identity of that community or just been wiped out. This is an opportunity to fill that void.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we cannot leave workers or communities behind as we take essential climate action, right? You know, for too many times in our history, we've assumed that technology shifts will just naturally bring workers and communities along, right? Like, that is just an automatic thing. This law rightly recognizes that an energy transition that is actually fair for workers and for communities needs to be a deliberate policy choice. Right. So as one example, there's one of the programs has about $10 billion in it to manufacture more wind and solar components, right? Creating good, typically high paying jobs, often union jobs. And $4 billion of that 10 is set aside for coal communities. $4 billion. And it's not just incentivized, it's actually set aside. So that's a healthy degree of investment that's going to be going into coal communities. These are communities that have seen recent closures of either a coal mine or a coal-fired power plant. They qualify. So that's a strong incentive, right, for anyone who's trying to set up a manufacturing facility to invest in places like West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky and Wyoming, you know, other places around the U.S. that have seen coal closures. So it's, you know, that's one example of several that are in the law to try to make a fair transition a deliberate policy choice.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because here's the thing. You said that we assume that the workers are going to be brought along. I never assumed that because right. I can't find a technological advancement that workers didn't take it on the chin in the frictional state of it being implemented. It's the same thing I fear with automation and robotics. I fear workers are going to end up being on the short end of the stick. This policy, and I'm glad you pointed it out, this Inflation Reduction Act is actually taking that into mind and trying to alleviate that problem. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, I know a lot of us really fought hard for that and really care about it.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, you know, like any policy, we're just a year into this. Not all the money's been rolled out. I don't know that it's all been promised. What are we looking for in the next year? I mean, how does this rollout happen? What should we be paying attention to?
Yeah. So like I said, the spigot is just barely open, right? The funding is going to really start flowing in the next year. And I think we actually commissioned a study to ask this question, like what can we anticipate? And we zoomed in on wind and solar. So maybe I'll just use that as an example, right? One of the things that they found is that just one of the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act is going to make it cheaper to manufacture wind and solar components in the United States than to import them for the first time in U.S. history. Right. So that's just it's a game changer for clean energy manufacturing. Right. Again, we have the opportunity to build cleaner, stronger, fairer supply chains for clean energy here. And that they estimate not only is it going to make it cheaper, but that means more investment, which means more jobs. And they estimated that it will create about 1.6 million jobs by 2035 and, you know, a number of jobs leading up to that. And that about 800,000 of those are in manufacturing, right? So it's like, you know, these are real numbers, folks. Like that is a sea change relative to the status quo. Another thing, just to name that study looked at was for not the manufacturing jobs, but the folks who are working to deploy the wind and solar power, working on construction, right? For the first time, it pays to pay workers well. That is, like, wind and solar companies can cut their costs by 60% if they pay prevailing wages and use apprenticeship programs to offer career pathways. And that's thanks to the structure of this Inflation Reduction Act. So again, real opportunities, if we get the details right, for climate, for jobs, and for justice.
No, and look, you know, for me, it's another reason why 2024 is so important politically, so that we don't end up going back on those, on this bill and on these investments. Again, another political time. But Ben, I appreciate you taking a little time, sharing some information. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Good stuff, Ben Beachy. He is the he's the vice president of industrial policy there at the Blue Green Alliance. Check out their website, bluegreenalliance.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. A quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around for listening to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that 101 leaders of the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, were convicted in Chicago federal court. Their alleged crime? Violating the Espionage Act during World War I by calling strikes in war industries and calling for an end to the draft. Those convicted included some of the leading names of the IWW. Big Bill Haywood, Ralph Chaplin, the author of Solidarity Forever, and Ben Fletcher, a black IWW organizer in Louisiana, were all found guilty. More IWW leaders awaited trial in California and Kansas. Federal raids swept up Wobbly leaders across the country. In all, more than 2,000 IWW members were arrested during the war. Kenesaw Mountain Landis presided as judge over the Chicago trial. In Chicago, the jury deliberated only a little more than an hour. They found every defendant guilty. Landis sentenced Big Bill Haywood and other top IWW leaders with 20 years in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. Ben Fletcher got 5 years. All of the men went to prison, except Haywood, who skipped bail and fled the country. The arrests and convictions were a devastating blow to the IWW. But the union did not completely disappear. New leaders emerged to carry on their mission of one big union. Their headquarters are still located in Chicago. President Calvin Coolidge commuted the sentences of those still in prison in 1923. As for Judge Landis, his action on being tough on so-called Reds earned him a national reputation. And so, in 1920, he became Major League Baseball's first commissioner, a post he would hold for more than two decades. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, this is one of those moments, have you noticed that you don't hear much about Jim Jordan anymore? You know, it seems like nobody cares about Jim Jordan anymore, or Bobo for that matter. I haven't heard much about Gun Fetish Barbie or Marjorie Three Names. Been kind of quiet on the crazy front. And I don't know if that's just the mainstream media just kind of taking a break, or they're just not producing fresh, crazy content. I don't know. But how many people saw that Jim Jordan's committee, the House Judiciary Committee, subpoenaed Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray, the FBI director? It was a small little story I saw. Wasn't a big deal. I know. The weaponization. They're weaponizing the government against poor, pitiful Donnie. Have you noticed something with the persecution of Donald Trump? Have you noticed that none of the people who are witnesses, none of the people who are involved are actually Democrats? Have you noticed that it's all Republicans? Somehow, Joe Biden has weaponized the Republican Party against themselves. It's crazy. It is literally crazy. Now, I look at what's going on down in Georgia, and you've got a state, I think it's a state senator, who's now looking into going after Fannie Willis because, you know, she's weaponized. They published the names of the jurors, the grand jurors, who were the ones who set down the indictment. And now you've got the Fulton County Sheriff's Department that are investigating threats against these jurors. And this is one of those things where there's part of me that goes, why do we publish the names of these grand jurors? Because you knew that, you know, crazy people are going to threaten them. And look, there are lunatics on all sides of the politics. But, you know, this promoting of violence that we see is crazy. For instance, in my neck of the woods, evidently, you know, some old woman was all angry, 69-year-old woman, charged with arson and other related crimes, when she set three fires to the home of the mayor in her town. I guess she really didn't like that decision that the mayor made. And this is one of these things where you go, explain to me why you would take this kind of action. Not, you know, crazy, you know, off the deep end, folks. For instance, also, you know, a woman with dual citizenship in France and Canada was in Canada, sent ricin, I believe it was, to Donald Trump and 8 Texas law enforcement officers. Now, I condemn all of it. This is stupid. It's terrible. She got 22 years in jail. So my mind goes, here's the baseline. 22 years in jail for sending ricin to Trump and to others. Okay. If you're threatening someone's life, if you're doing all this stuff, pretty good place. So all of you crazy people who are going to threaten these grand jury folks, there's the bar. Is it worth it? You look at what happened out in Utah, and I know my crazy right-wing friends are, we've never killed anybody when the FBI comes to their door. Really? you point a gun at an FBI agent, they're going to shoot you. And this is where the MAGA folks have kind of got to be worried, because they've all got arsenals, and people know they've got arsenals. So don't make threats against people. Don't do it. And it's so bad. It's so bad that the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, and I didn't even know there was a group called the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State. Evidently, they have started a tax-exempt 501c4 organization called Value the Vote in 5 states, Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, Nevada, Wisconsin, with one of the sole purposes to protect election officers, to protect the officials who, you know, take care of that show up for election day. Evidently, they've raised $2.5 million of the $10 million that they need. But this is, are you kidding me? They're raising money to pay private security for election officials of both parties, because, you know, crazy doesn't know any bounds. There seem to be a lot of red hat crazy, though. And they're going to evidently protect those folks and then register new voters and try and combat disinformation. And I'm going, $10 million? That's all you're going to, that's all, you think you're going to do all that with $10 million? It's crazy where we are, isn't it? And I'll tell you, you know, 20 years ago, you know, I knew things were getting heated. I knew we were a little tense. Never would imagine where we are today. Never imagine how mean we are to each other, how hateful and spiteful that you see people, especially people who view the others. And I'm of the mindset of, you know, how do we organize people to come back together, get between the curbs and hammer out what are real problems? Because as I started today's show off on, you know, that Anthony Oliver, or Oliver Anthony is his name, the guy with the Richmond song, he's hit a nerve that working people need to understand. And he's got a story. He's authentic. He's a real guy who's suffering real consequences. The question is will we take this moment and come together, or will we use this as another thing to divide us? Will this be the thing that can draw us together? Will this be the spark? Can it be? Because at the end of the day, if we start focusing on the right things, like the reasons that our education system is failing, the reason that our cities are crumbling, our rural communities are struggling, if we focused on the real problems and said, hey, let's fix those, and we focused on the reason why we're in the situation we're in, you know, the rich people ain't gonna be very happy. Because you talk to people, they want a higher tax code for the very wealthy. They believe they're taxed enough already. They're struggling to put food.